As I spoke with the people in Katani and on Cocos, it soon became clear to me that they weren't illiterate as was presented to me, that actually at different points in time there had been schools on the island. On certain occasions there were several schools, on other occasions there were only one school. Sometimes in the single school they were taught in Malay, sometimes they were taught in English, and on several points in time they were actually taught by the Clunies Ross family, members of the Clunies Ross family. At other times they were taught by teachers who had been brought in, and at one point in time they were taught by a teacher who had come from Singapore. Okay. Now each of those occasions throughout the history, we're talking over a century, the education system was quite different. But what did surprise me was that the people I spoke with in Katanning, some of them, the older ones, not only could read and write, but they could read and write in the Jawi script, which is the Arabic form of a Malay script, or the Malay form of an Arabic script, I should say. And when I told this to Haji Adam, the fellow I showed before, Haji Adam said, yes, of course they could read and write. There was a school teaching that. There was also, at one point when he was growing up, a school teaching English used in Roman script and also teaching Malay used in Roman script. Okay, so again, as a writer, thinking of the script of the Clunies Ross signature, I thought, well, this is very interesting. You know, like, there's this script which was quite widely used, and from about the 14th century, it was actually the predominant script of the whole of Indonesia, Malaysia, and even in South Africa there were people who were able to write in it in about the 18th and 19th centuries. And if you were a colonial official, British colonial or Dutch official, you probably could write it as well. Okay, but now it's not common. When I was asking people, some people who teach Indonesian and Malay, many people were telling me, oh, no one uses it, no one knows it. And so I started digging around, like, what's that about? And actually, there was a point in time, the fellow who printed the images for my show, who was brought up in Malaysia, his mother was Chinese, his father's Indian, he learnt it at school. So it was actually within Malaysia, it was the beginning of a Malay nationalist education. The script was actually taught, and then it got phased out into a Roman script. So again, there's scriptural tradition which goes back very far, starts disappearing under these national regimes. But it interested me, like, what's this about, and how does it affect their own knowledge? It was Haji Adam behind him in the Centrelink office had this filing cabinet full of Jawi letters that he had been collecting as people were passing away. He was collecting the letters from the family. So I thought, well, look, I'm not going to learn how to write Jawi. I don't have the time to do that, like, it's not my thing. But I would like to make a point of that. Like, I think this is something, and when I spoke with some people in Katanning, like, there were a few people who are trying to learn it. And I said, well, this is really for them to access their own history. Just learning that script will make a huge, huge advance, because the historian in Canberra who's done probably the most interesting work on this, he doesn't read Jawi, so he couldn't read all those things, and he didn't know Haji Adam had that cabinet, okay? So it's a very banal fact, like, who can read the script? And then that transforms a whole lot of memories, or creates memories, or reclaims memories. So I sort of had then at that point a kind of a frame, like, I wanted to do something with text, I wanted to do something with Malay and Jawi, I wanted to do something thinking about the early history, looking to the past, the origins of the people, but also how, like, they arrived on the island, because there was this period up until about 1860 when there were two groups of Malay peoples. Up until 1860, there was one principal group. Then in the 1860s, another group arrived from Java. And they actually had two different towns, two kampungs, villages, on this single island called Home Island. And so I was interested in, like, what was the differentiation between those two groups, and what was the origin of the original group, and what was this dynamic between Clunies Ross and Alexander Hare? this was to be the project, okay? And as I was on the island, going from West Island to Home Island, which is about 8 kilometres across the lagoon on the ferry, which is very awkwardly timed because I think they don't want visitors that much. And so there's only like 3 or 4 ferries a day. The last ferry's at 3:30. There's almost nowhere to stay on Home Island if you want to stay there. So it's got this strange awkwardness where all the non-Malays are on West Island, 100 of them, and 500 of the Malays are on this tiny island, West Island. So you're going across on the ferry. And I kept looking across at this island. I've got 3 images because the thing about it is it looks really different from different angles. It's the same island. And that's the same island. I kept looking at this island because this was coming up in my reading. This was the island where Alexander Hare was said to have ended his days on the atoll. It's not a very good island to be on. It's at the top of the atoll. It's very small. There's various pictures of it. In my exhibition, I have a picture that makes it look like almost a different island where it was much higher. But like when you're cruising along and you go visiting the other islands, you think, this is ridiculous. Like, why did he end up there? That doesn't make sense. There's no water. It's not easy to get around from. Why was he intentionally isolating himself there? What was driving that? And there was something driving it, which sort of became clearer, although I don't know the facts of it, but it became clearer that something very peculiar was going on as I started reading about Alexander Hare. Okay. So the narrative that's in the book, that's the core of the project, is actually to do with this question of, like, Alexander Hare, who was he? Why did he bring the slaves? How come he's been erased from the history and the Clunies Ross family has taken over this idea that they brought the Malay people to the island? So that's really the core of the story. Now, Alexander Hare, of whom there's no pictures, and actually the more recent the publications that refer to the Cocos, the less that's said about Alexander Hare. So I started to dig around, and as I said, I found this book that had these documents pertaining just to Alexander Hare. And what I realised was actually Alexander Hare was a really, really peculiar and interesting and maybe very problematic person. Okay, he was born in London. He went to work in Calcutta or Mumbai, I think in Calcutta, probably at about the age of about... No, he first went to Lisbon, actually. He went from London to Lisbon to Calcutta. Then he went from there to Malacca. And in Malacca, he stayed for at least probably 15 years, okay? And what I realised is pretty much everything that was written about Alexander Hare, except what was in this book of real documents, said that Alexander Hare was at least a womanizer, probably worse, a very bad person, a colonial of the worst sort, and basically he arrived on these islands with a harem of 40 women. And that's repeated in all the texts, a harem of 40 women. That's repeated pretty much everywhere. Now, when you read back, like when you do historical research, it's always interesting. You sort of read back and then you trace where people are quoting one another from, you know. And what I realised is some of the things that were said were from the same sources, okay. But when I looked at who was on the ship, you realised there were 40 women and about 56 men, okay. And so I was like, well, that's kind of interesting. Like, what do you make of that? And they came with, I don't remember the number of children, okay. So I was like, well, that's, maybe it's not the 40 women in the harem exactly. I don't know, but... and so then I started to look more carefully at, like, what was being said about Alexander Hare, okay? And in the earlier texts, you realise that he was actually quite a well-regarded figure in Malacca and that he was very connected to what they call the country traders, which were people who had been working for the British East India Company and who then became independent traders, which wasn't totally legal, but was a good way to make some money. Okay, and that they were doing like circular trade within the Indies, making their profits and then taking the profits away. So not actually trading anything back to Europe. And he was quite connected with those and also with the sultans and the rajas of various parts of what's now Indonesia and Malaysia, but mostly Malaysia because that was the British part. And it was said, you know, he spoke several of the languages. He was often visited as an advisor. He was consulted by Stanford Raffles, who's probably the key person in that part of the world from the British point of view. And he was actually a friend of Raffles, okay? But, so the first thing you do is you go look at the biographies of Raffles and you look at the index, what's said about him there? And again, the more recent ones, he's actually not there. The biography by Lady Raffles, he's not there. There's a very substantial biography of Raffles that actually has a fair amount. In fact, a letter that Raffles wrote to Hare when Hare was on this island, which I'll maybe refer to a bit later. But so Hare has this household of slaves in Malacca, and according to reports, there's a larger part to the story as well. I'll just tell you the story that's more relevant to his arrival on the islands. But he gets involved in various things. At one point, he has a settlement in Borneo, which was under certain regimes considered illegal. It was against the policies of the British East India Company, so he gets into trouble there. He joins the Java expedition led by Lord Minto, and again, he's erased from most of those accounts, even though it seems he was a key figure in terms of getting support from other parts of that part of the world. Then he has properties in Java, and then at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, the Dutch take back their territories. I think it's under the Treaty of Utrecht. I'm not quite sure, can't recall. So the Dutch take back their territories, so they say the British must leave. Okay. The Dutch actually start a propaganda campaign against the British, using Alexander Hare as an example, particularly his colony in Borneo. And so Hare leaves sort of in disgrace, and the British don't want to deny him because he's like messing up their relationship with the Dutch. He's misbehaving in various ways. They say, like, you must leave Java, you must leave Malacca, sort yourself out. So he goes to Cape Town with his household of slaves. And at this point in time, slavery is ending. It's not illegal to own slaves, but it is illegal to sell slaves. So as I was reading the accounts, what seemed to me is that he was trying to probably sell them. Okay. So he gets to Cape Town. He sets up a farm there. And he's there for 5 years. And there's some suggestion of scandal in Cape Town. Okay. So then he leaves again. But there's a very, very interesting moment where he's actually in discussion with Clunies Ross, saying that he's planning to go back to the East. He doesn't want to go back to Europe. And Clunies Ross says, I have a similar idea. Why don't we go to some islands? So they actually had some islands that they thought of going to. Cocos was one. Clunies Ross goes back to England. Hare sails to Cocos. Okay. Clunies Ross arrives on Cocos about 9 months later. He's like, oh, we're here. Hare's like, no, I don't want you to be here. These are my islands. I claim them all. You can have the southernmost one. Now, as I said, there's 21, and they're mostly very small except for West Island. So Clunies Ross is there, not very happy. Hare is there with these with his workers. So we're talking about 90 people, okay. And so obviously Clunies Ross is not very happy, and Hare is just perennially not very happy. And what sort of starts to happen is Hare starts doing strange things, like he moves around all the islands and he bans Clunies Ross from all the islands from fishing on the islands. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, this is like 800 kilometers from Christmas Island. It's pretty far away from everywhere. Then he builds himself a house here. And I find it hard to believe, but all the documents say that he did. He builds himself a house on this, which is called Prison Island, or it's called Pulau Bras, which means like Rice Island. He builds himself a house. And the description of the style of the house is very interesting for anyone who's been to like various parts of Southeast Asia, because he builds a house with a kind of, what would you call it, like a kind of a storage area underneath. And then there's a platform, and then there's the house itself and the thatch. And he decides that he's going to keep many of the single women under the house. Okay? And he's going to keep their children, for their safety, in something that they call a kraal, which in South Africa is like an enclosure for livestock. So he builds his house with a fence around it. He builds an enclosure for the children with a fence around it. So it's not looking very pretty now, is it? And so I thought, well, what's going on here? Like, this is getting bizarre, you know. It's really, this is clearly probably someone going mad, actually. And so I thought, well, you know, like, this is what needs to be understood. Like, these people have come from the household in Malacca, where many of them were given as gifts by sultans. They were taken to live on a plantation in Java, where they probably had a nice enough time. Then they're taken through various ports, possibly to be sold. And at this point in time, it's illegal for them to be sold. They're taken to Cape Town. They're made to work on the farm. And most of these were household servants. They weren't familiar with farm labour. So some even ran away and made reports to the magistrate in Cape Town. So then after 6 years, Hare decides to go back, and he actually sailed to various slave ports, most of them illegal slave ports up the coast of East Africa and some on the coast of Sumatra, like the island of Nias. It's a famous surfing spot off the coast of Sumatra, which was a slaving port. It's not said explicitly, but it seems like he was trying to sell the people. Then he lands up on Cocos, and then this starts to happen, this craziness. So I thought, well, this is what needs to be understood, because this is the beginning of his decline, this is the beginning of their abandonment, and this is also the point at which the Clunies, John Clunies Ross is seeing that if he wants those islands, which he ultimately does get, he has to get those workers, because he only came with about 14 settlers, all European, most of whom were leaving for Perth, strangely enough, after being there for a while. And so the story that's contained in here, the drama of it, is really about this conflict, like what is going on between these two white men, the owners, and the slaves who are with them, and especially the woman who had children with Alexander Hare, some of whom, three of whom were seen by Charles Darwin when he visited the islands. Okay. And I thought, well, that's really the seeds not only of the people being there, but of the cultural logic of the island, which was a Malay cultural logic, but under this British feudal system. There's even weirder aspects to it than that, but I think I can't really go into them. So that's what the text becomes. And I thought, well, I'd like to write this text. And it has to be a fiction, because I don't think the people in Katanning or on the islands are going to read it if I write a history. I think maybe a few of them would. But if it's a story, I think they'll listen to the story and maybe contribute to it by criticising it in various ways that I can absorb. So I started writing. So the book itself is the text that I was writing, but I originally wanted it to be a radio play. Because I read somewhere, and I don't think this is true anymore, that they actually had one radio station on two frequencies, one for West Island, where the non-Malays are, and one for Home Island, where the Malays are. So I thought, that's really cool. Why don't I just broadcast it on both frequencies in different languages, one in Malay, one in English? So that's what I started writing, thinking I could do this. Okay, so I wrote the text. I discovered that the people who run the radio station more or less don't want to correspond with the outside world, so it hasn't gone to the next step. But I wrote the text, so it can still be produced, and maybe it won't be produced there, but maybe it will be somewhere else. And it consists of 8 episodes, each episode of which is a significant event in those first 5 years, in this contest between the two, Alexander Hare and Clunies Ross, but also revealing other dynamics there. Like, one thing I discovered bizarrely is that the chef who works at the only restaurant on West Island is Portuguese, And the Clunies Ross chef in 1825 was Portuguese, okay? And so I started thinking about that, like he would have come from Malacca. What would he have been thinking of these things? How would he have related to the Malay people, since he was just of the servant class for the British Clunies Ross? Okay, so that's like there's an episode like that. There's another episode which talks about the letter I mentioned before, which is quoted maybe in its entirety in an early biography of Stanford Raffles written in the 19th century. And that letter I had read about in other biographies of Raffles and elsewhere, because it describes when Raffles met Napoleon on St. Helena. Okay, now there's two things, like that's an island too, so I thought, well, that's very interesting, like these two figures, like Hare and Clunies Ross meeting on this island, okay. I thought, well, what would that mean if it's told as a story by the Malay women who are hearing this, you know? Because in most of the texts written on the islands, they portray Hare as this sinister character, which I don't doubt, okay? But they also say that Raffles had nothing to do with him after being in Java, which is clearly not true, because why did Raffles write in this letter about meeting Napoleon? And when you read the tone of it, it's very interesting. And his descriptions of Napoleon, he calls him, he looks like a Portuguese of Brazil, as short as a Portuguese of Brazil, and he's as rude as a Dutchman of Malacca. Okay, so I thought, well, you know, what would happen if this was discussed by these slaves there? So that's one of the episodes, and that is actually the episode that in the exhibition part of the project is reproduced in English on the wall, but also in Jawi script on the wall. And what I did after writing the text is I had the entire text translated into Malay, and I also, and this was quite tricky, found someone to write the whole text in Jawi script. So in the book it's English-Malay, but we will probably do the Jawi script version at some point. At least it can be studied at SOAS in London, if nowhere else, where they still teach Jawi. Yeah, so that sort of describes the project. So the project, I'll show you an image of the installation. I'll play the audio afterwards. I'll just mention some things in the future that are sort of relevant to it as well. But basically what it becomes in the end so far, it's not really the end because this project will go to Katanning in July. It was exhibited in the Western Australian Museum as part of Space to Future Recall. And there we showed some maps, reproduction of maps, one of which shows the atolls with the Malay names, as well as where it's situated in relation to Java and Sumatra. There's a picture of the island, Pulau Bras, which was taken in 1950s. And it's very interesting because the island's probably about 2 meters high at that point. And then there's an image of the island that I took myself that's in there. And there's the audio, which I'll play a bit of now at the end, which was recorded with the people in Katanning using my text. And there's several reasons I did that. One of which was, I think for them, it was a way of reconnecting to the islands because I think the people on the islands regard the people who went to Australia as no longer Cocos Malays. Okay, so you have these weird kind of subtle chauvinisms that you encounter. So like the Cocos Malays on Christmas Island are not so much Cocos Malays, and the Cocos Islands on the mainland are something different. And for them, I think in Katanning, it is difficult to retain this idea of being connected to the islands because I've met quite a few who've only been to the islands once. Whereas the people on the islands actually get a government-sponsored ticket to go to the mainland if they want. Okay, but people who want to go from the mainland have to fork out 1,300, 1,500 to fly to Cocos. Okay, so there's these sort of weird dynamics. And so I think that's why they quite liked the project in Katanning. I think the people in Cocos, they're just like happy. They couldn't care if I did the project or not. Like, they're not really that interested in the history as far as I can tell. So just to jump forward to contextualize all of this in a different way, and these are the images that are actually reproduced in the book. This is the leader of the UN decolonization mission on his second visit to the islands. This occurred, I think, in 1982, not quite sure of the year. And this is Krebin Haag, who was, under Clunies Ross, the headman, and who became the chairperson of the cooperative, which is the business that runs the islands. And he has a very favourable view of the Clunies Ross family. And he's looking very happy to see the decolonisation mission as well, nonetheless. And this is an image of their traditional dance, which is actually an amazing hybrid. I don't know much about it, but there is a musicologist studying this at the moment. Their hybrid style of dress, but also the hybrid style of dance and music. As you can see, there's fiddlers. And they, the music is actually a mix of Scottish traditional music and Malay music. So it's kind of a bit, it's not for everyone, I have to say. On YouTube, if you're interested, there is, I did a video of one of the violinists playing, so it is there. It's a bit too short though, but so if you're curious, you can hear it. But this is also historically very interesting because actually when you look at the inventories, as they called it, of slaves in households in Cape Town or in Batavia, they very often included fiddlers and other musicians. And so I see that as part of this long continuum. Tailors in Cape Town, the Malay people in Cape Town, who have a sort of connected but different history, they're very famous for being tailors as well. And so it's kind of interesting to see that lineage. That's why it was a shock for them to go to South Africa and be made to labour, because these were not labouring people. Like, they were living in a metropolitan centre, Malacca. Like, it would have been shocking for them to be sent into the fields. And even more shocking for them to arrive in Cocos, and the guy's saying to them, Hare's saying, well, go out from dawn till dusk, collect coconuts, half an hour for lunch, that's it. So, like, they'd be traumatised just by that, let alone all the other dreadful things that they probably faced. I like that picture, and that's on the cover of the book as well. So, and this was the reason for that visit of the decolonisation mission. It was to inspect the educational facilities that were being set up on Cocos, and I think because we in the privileged West are so used to the idea that everyone's literate, this is something really important to think about. Like, what is the intervention of literacy? Because the UN knew that literacy is necessary for the referendum. Okay, but I also find this a very moving picture, actually, because I if you see the details of how they've dressed up for the day, and he's got like long trousers on, and she's got her watch, yeah. And her earrings. And so I suppose, like, in a way, this question of, like, the Jawi script and the story and the narrative, I see it as kind of connecting with this, like, just reading and writing. This is the installation. So this is in the Western Australian Museum for, I don't know, Ben would probably know it, but I don't know if many other people would know. This was the old Western Australian Museum. It's called Hackett Hall. So down here, there's the large hall. It's a 19th century building. And then this was the State Library formerly. So the books actually went along these mezzanine kind of catwalks. And so that's the image of the island I mentioned. The map, another map, another image of the island. And then the text, and then the audio is here. I don't know how we're going for time. I can play the audio, if that's fine. How are we for? Well, we can just play a bit of it, or there's three segments. It's about 8 minutes for one. Okay. Escape. Yeah. So as I said, this is the audio recorded with Siti, but also with several other members of the community and sort of edited together. There was the idea to do the whole text and to do it bilingual, but I have to say, like, when I did the editing of this, it was sort of enough.
The slaves could not say for how long they had been on the islands. Pulau Buras was the female slaves' home now. The imam would have known, but he was on Pulau Panjang with some of the men. Rosie and the woman had not seen him since the slaves had been separated. Tuan Alexander had sent the men to set up camps on almost all of the islands. He only allowed Tuan John and his men to have one or two of the islands. Tuan John had only a few people with him, his family and some English workers, and the Portuguese cook, who had been with them since Malacca. Rosie sometimes spoke with the cook in the Portuguese. Tuan Alexander was much stricter on the islands than he had ever been before, even in the Cape, when they had to work so hard on the farm, planting crops, picking grapes, and all those other jobs that had been done for them by local slaves in Java. But in the Cape, he had not been bad-tempered and agitated. In the Cape and in Java, there had been only a few occasions where one of the men was flogged, and Tuan Alexander had never before separated the male from the female slaves and their children. Tuan Alexander had always recognized that many of them were married, even if they had only been married by the imam. It was true that the imam was not an imam educated in a mosque. Still, he knew more than anyone else did about prayers and rituals. They believed everything he told them. Now they were on the islands, and it seemed that Tuan Alexander did not know where he could take them next. Even if he did say that one day, once he had made the arrangements to regain ownership of his plantation, he would take them back to live in Java. Everyone liked the idea of returning to Java. It was not as good as Malacca, but it was better than being in Africa or on these lonely islands so far from everywhere. As soon as they reached the islands, Tuan Alexander had separated the men from the women, the boys from the girls. Many of the married slaves were allowed to live together unless Tuan Alexander believed that the husband had done something wrong, in which case he would keep the wife with him on Pulau Buras. Mostly it was the childless woman whom Tuan Alexander kept with him. On their arrival on the islands, he had told the slaves in the land that separating them from one another was to protect the purity of the woman, to keep the children safe. He did not want the girls to become pregnant or the boys to hurt themselves or drown. When some of the men tried to object, he had spoken to them in harsh English. Those few who could understand him kept quiet, knowing that he was warning them that if anyone disobeyed him, they would be whipped or drowned.
Tuan Alexander said that he wished he had brought the Dutch overseer with him from his farm in the Cape, that savage man who whipped us when we were working out in the fields, swearing at us in his strange Dutch or in his divinished Portuguese.
When Tuan Alexander had addressed them on their arrival on the islands, he had held up the whip he had brought from Cape Town, a whip made of leather of a rhino. None of them had ever seen a rhino, yet they could imagine it clearly when they closed their eyes. An animal large as an elephant with a single long horn that could stab through a man faster than a spear. They feared that being whipped with that would be like being speared over and over. What made Duan Alexander think like that? What made him so cruel?
Maybe all of them wanted the same. Even though she was Nyai Dua, she was kept with other female slaves in the cave under Duan Alexander's house on Pulau Bras. Only Nyai Satu could sleep with Duan Alexander in the room above them. Duan Alexander sent the single men and the married couples to the other islands, where they had to work from dawn until dusk, with only half an hour for food at midday, without a day of rest. Brazy and the other women and girls worked in the day on Pulau Bras, or sometimes on the islands, finding coconuts, making palm oil, and boiling seawater for salt. At night, they were all locked up under Duan Alexander's house. They called their new home the cave. The girls were with them there, while the boys were kept in the kraal, like what the dark-skinned people in the cave used for the animals, beyond the two tall fences surrounding Duan Alexander's house. There were two fences around Duan Alexander's house, one around the kraal. Duan Alexander explained that the fences were needed to protect the woman from Duan John's men. Duan John's men were all European and all unmarried. To those slaves he knew about the tribes in Borneo and Sumatra, the cave was like a cage. Only animals or prisoners should be made to live in. Rosie did not see it like that. To her, the cave was a dark, safe place, somewhere she could hide among the women. There she could keep her baby close to her. Her older boy was in the kraal. Even if they were like prisoners, at least they were together on one island.
Because they are Duan Alexander's sons, he will always take care of us.
None of them could know how long they had already been on the islands. Occasionally, they would hear something from the imam, who, observing the moon or talking with sailors from a passing ship who were buying supplies from the Duan John settlement, knew which year it was. How long they had been on the islands? None of the slaves had much clothing. Each had only a sarong, except Nyai Satu, who had two sarongs, enough cloth to cover her breast, and there was little food for the nearly 100 slaves, the one Alexander's orang cake. Being on this island was nothing like being in Malacca, Java or the Cape. It was like being on a big calm ship. On those days when Rosie was able to wander away from her task for a while, she would go to the north side of the Finding Island and stare at the open ocean, this angry grey, like the ocean at the cape. Then she would quietly, sadly, think of nothing.